Dr. Brzezinski, thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your career path, the kinds of choices you've made, the kinds of lessons you've learned, in order to give people a better sense for how they can apply those lessons to their own lives. And one of the things that I noticed about your career is you started in academia and you made a transition into government. And now you've been going in both worlds. What was the key to your being able to make that transition from an academic track into a policy track?
First of all, none of that was designed deliberately. A lot of these so-called accommodations, shifts, whatever in life, are the products of circumstances, of opportunities. In my case, I think what probably gave me a sense of purpose and continuity in what I did was the fact that I was very much a product of World War II. And even though as a kid, young kid, I was totally preoccupied with what was happening in the world. And then as a young adolescent and then student and graduate student, I was very conscious of the fact that we're living in a period of what I would consider, at least I'd considered, of unfinished business. Hitlerism was defeated. Stalinism was very much alive and a threat. And I think that sort of focused my attentions. When I went to Harvard to do my graduate work, I did not have a clear notion of what exactly I would be doing professionally. But I had a fairly clear idea what it is that I want to be engaged in. And that was in some way participating in the process of deciphering the inner message of Stalinism, its potential for success, and thinking of ways of counteracting that. And of course, at that time, Soviet studies were just beginning to appear on the scene. And that is where I gravitated to, as a scholar. And what I can say, without sounding terribly immodest, though it even sounds that way, I was very successful at Harvard. Everything was just like that for me. And pretty soon, you know, I was considered to be the bright young guy in the Soviet field, quite literally. And that then led very easily to a connection with the world of politics, even though I didn't design it that way. And I, of course, came rapidly to realize that if I am purposeful and in my notions, if they have some sort of a strategic goal, then the link to politics is absolutely essential. And then it became increasingly easy for me to be absorbed into that. And again, chance, of course, played its own role, meeting this person, that person. But that would be the broad context.
When you set goals for yourself, have you set a lot of small goals? Did you set big multi-year strategic goals? How do you balance between the immediate goals of getting through the week and the longer-term career goals? Or did the career take care of itself because you were successful in the smaller things?
There's no doubt that the second was certainly a factor. I did not plan my sort of life like the Soviet five-year plans, shorter or longer, as the case may be. I had certain goals which were connected, first of all, with my academic status. But then increasingly, these goals began to fuse with attempts to influence policy, because what I was writing drew attention. John Kennedy, a senator, became interested in what I was saying. Nelson Rockefeller became interested in what I was saying. And one thing led to another. And as I began to sense that the connection between ideas and action is feasible, and action can lead to the attainment of goals that I instinctively felt were motivating me, namely to counteract the Soviets, to make the Cold War a success without a huge human tragedy like World War II. In other words, see if we can win without a war. And then that led me to formulate by the early, well, in fact, by the late 50s already, a kind of third alternative to the prevailing doctrines. One was containment, and of course George Kennan associated himself with that. And that was a kind of automatic containment, which some people misinterpreted as pointing to the necessity of a great armaments program and military confrontation. And this is where Kennan was disappointed with some of his supporters. And then in the 60s, Henry Kissinger began to write about the need for balance, stability, equilibrium, and nuclear deterrence on the basis of the status quo. And I was not satisfied with either one. The first simply seemed to me to be too rigid and by itself would not cause any change. The second seemed to me to be an accommodation of the status quo. And I began to be increasingly convinced through my own studies and then traveled to the Soviet bloc that there were massive internal vulnerabilities in the Soviet bloc. If we were to understand them correctly, we could exploit them. And that led me to formulate the doctrine of peaceful engagement, which then President Johnson actually literally embraced. And then, of course, I had the unique opportunity of pursuing it in the White House.
Right. Now, everybody hasn't always agreed with you. You've had critics sometimes in politics. You never know where the reality is because you're praised for the wrong reasons and you're criticized for the wrong reasons.
Yeah, of course.
As you have put forward your ideas, how have you maintained your center? What have you done to make sure that when you're being criticized, it's constructive and helps you modify your views, and that the unjust criticism doesn't divert you or distract you from pursuing what you saw to be the truth?
You know, that's very hard to answer on this kind of broad, general level. Somehow or other, I was never really particularly disturbed by criticisms. And of course, I enjoyed praise. It's only human. But maybe that was my academic background. Namely, I was accustomed to debate, to discussion, and to criticism in the course of debate. And therefore, that to me was part of the normal process, which in a way helped to hone your own tools to improve your ideas. So it really didn't bother me too much. I've been criticized in a variety of ways up to this day for some, you know, things which some people say without having the slightest idea that the implications of what they're saying is not on, are not only totally slanderous, but even dangerous. But that's part of the game.
Now, when you're criticizing others in politics, sometimes you need to hold your tongue. Sometimes, for political reasons, you can't tell people exactly what you think. How have you thought about the situations in which it's better to wait versus being in a more academic environment where you just tell people exactly what you think up front?
Well, to me, the academic environment and my own academic background increasingly became incidental to policymaking or influencing policy if I couldn't make it directly. Became the major interest of my life and still is right now. And then in that case, you make tactical decisions regarding reactions. In some cases, you hold your tongue because it's tactically more desirable. In some cases, you try to overwhelm the alternative that you don't like. You can't generalize on that. But it becomes much more political. Judgments are then not purely academic, correct, not correct, innovative, repetitive, or whatever that academics are concerned about. It becomes essentially what kind of a reaction is more productive in serving the political objective that you're striving to achieve.
Did you have a sort of a mentor who helped you make that transition to this political world where you're thinking about the tactics, you're thinking about how to have the policy impact? Was there somebody who sort of led you through that? Did you have a range of people that you learned from?
Well, not really. Not a mentor helping me do that. But in the Harvard environment of the 1950s, the professors that I was associated with and under whom I studied and whom I respected, they were my professors because I gravitated towards them. Were people who very often made a trip to Washington. And that, of course, intrigued me right away, given my instinctive inclination. So in that sense, I was, in a sense, indirectly trained by them to enter that process and to be part of that kind of a quasi-academic, quasi-political game, but with me increasingly shifting to more preponderantly political game. And also I had, so to speak, colleagues, fellow graduate students at Harvard who were moving that way. Even though he was several years older than me, Henry Kissinger and I were sort of very visible in the Harvard context. And he was a very impressive, successful example of doing what I was also striving to do, and in a sense setting a path. I often wondered in subsequent years whether I would have become national security advisor if he hadn't become one first, because neither he nor I were American born. There was not the tradition of having foreign-born Americans at the highest level of government, as it is now almost normal. When Henry became national security advisor, he was the first foreign-born person at that exalted position. But he had already one advantage over me. He had an Anglo-Saxon Germanic name, which is more or less part of the norm. Sort of Germanic, Germanic-Jewish, English-Irish names were more or less traditionally okay at the highest level of government. I don't think I might have become national security advisor if he hadn't been one first, and became kind of celebrated the fact that he was foreign-born. What was distinctive about me was the fact that my name is totally, so to speak, non-traditional in terms of the elite structure, totally. On the first day I assumed my office in the White House, the president wrote a handwritten note to the entire White House staff saying simply, learn how to spell and pronounce Zbigniew Brzezinski. It was that odd. Now today, you know, we have Chinese names, we have Hindu names, we have all sorts of names at the cabinet level and so forth. America has changed enormously in the course of the last 40 or so years. And all of that contributed, in a sense, to making it more palatable for me to do what I was kind of instinctively driven to try to do.
Have you mentored other younger people who've tried to follow your path? And as you look at people on your teams, what kinds of things do you look for in your team members?
Well, I don't mentor them deliberately. I hope I mentor them simply by example, style, the nature of my preoccupations. I've had a series of associates, for example, here at CSIS, in the course of my now three-decade connection with it. And out of my research assistants, I have among them the head of the foundation. I have among them a person who's been a well-known academic dean. I have a former Secretary of State who was my student. And there are others in prominent positions. Now, I didn't mentor them, but maybe my own preoccupations and their association with what I was trying to do, for example, in writing, gave them some notion of what can be done if you have the ambition to shape events. Not only be a pure academic, but use serious scholarship as a tool of action, historically significant action. And I think that's something that perhaps is imbued by a kind of osmosis. I don't preach, I don't lecture. I give them assignments, ask them to do things, ask them to do things with me, and maybe some find that useful. I think that's important. To me, what was always important was to be associated with a grand idea, some sort of strategic concept of the future, kind of shape history. And then there are many ways, many different levels at which you are sometimes lucky enough to be doing it.
You've been on all kinds of teams. You just described the teamwork. What's the most successful team you've been on, and why has it worked so well?
Well, first of all, my own research assistants, I think, have been an exceptional group over the years. I mean, really, if I look back at them. But secondly, I think my own staff on the NSC has been described by people who have studied the NSC as perhaps the best staff that there was. And I made a point of working with them, that is to say, engaging them. That, to some extent, was also a function of a very deliberate decision, namely, not to make the staff too large, but not to make it too small. Kennedy had only about 10 people on his NSC staff. And President Obama has 240. That's way too many. I had about 35 to 40. But I made it a point of working with them in the sense that not only did I give them specific daily assignments or whatever they may be, but I had a weekly meeting with all of them for about an hour and a half, in which I spoke very openly to them about my relationship with the president, what I told the president, what he told me, and so forth, on one condition, that they do not gossip about it outside in a way that would embarrass me or the NSC or the president, of course. And it never happened. And yet I did that deliberately because I knew they were putting in 12 to 14 hours a day. And I'm not kidding, 12 to 14 hours a day. And they had to have some reward for it. And I knew that in the Washington setting, being on the NSC gave them a certain status. They are from the White House. And they had to validate that status by occasionally dropping some remark about what the president allegedly said or how he feels about something. And I told them, do it. But remember about the possible repercussions if you're being unwise. And I never had a problem. The second thing I did was to keep in touch with them, all 40 of them, on a daily basis. How? They were not authorized to leave the office in the White House without writing me a one-page memo reporting on everything they did, just one page. Key meetings with foreign diplomats, key cables read that were of significance, key actions recommended, key meetings with newspaper people. And then there was a spot saying, do you have any questions you want to ask me regarding any of the above? I would get a book with 40 pages in it. And as I was driven home, I would read it. And I would write in the margin, okay, come see me. No, or whatever. Or give me a further report on this. Which meant that every one of them was in touch with me every day. And then next day, the whole book, minus my responses to them individually, would be available to any staffer so he could see what the other guys are doing, or dolls. We had some women also, although that was not as often as now. And the reason for that is very simple. They were geographically or functionally divided, but there are bound to be overlaps. They're also bound to be, that's human, jealousies. So each person wanted to know what his closest neighbor, associate, maybe rival was doing. And this way each of them was informed. Well, I think that was good for them. It was also good for me. And kept my staff totally loyal. It's very important.
As you thought about striking this balance and thinking about time management, about getting things done, about working paper, you talked about this whole process of having memos. Were there strategies you learned to deal with information management, time management, that were helpful in making you successful as you worked your way from the academic world into the policy world?
Well, this is going to be a very trite response to a difficult question. Simply scanning what you read is absolutely essential. I used to get about 300 pages a day, addressed not to me, but to the president, from Secretary of State, DCI, the Secretary of Defense, blah, blah, blah. There's no way the president could read that because others were also pouring stuff to him through the domestic staff. So I had to decide, so to speak, what goes to him. Well, there's no way I could do that by reading every single page. I had to learn how to quickly scan it, skim it, and then say, yep, this goes to him. No, this, I respond on his behalf because I know what his position is. Well, that's kind of, you know, it's a different approach. In academia, you read something seriously. You make marginal notes. You think about it. You try to extract the essence of the wisdom that's being conveyed, in some cases, not all of academic work has that much wisdom in it, but some of it does. It's a different style. Speed is absolutely essential. But also, what I mentioned earlier, some sort of a larger concept of a grander idea, a broader strategy, a historical ambition, not for yourself, but for the United States, has to motivate what you do. Because then you know how to make judgments. But to do that, you also have to have some understanding of the historical context in which you find yourself. You find the U.S. as part of it. You find the world. I was essentially operating in a historical context, which was the aftermath. Well, it was not the aftermath. It was the continuation of the great struggles for global hegemony, which surfaced in the 20th century. And I was in office during the culminating phase of that struggle, when two powers really were competing for global hegemony. And that sort of defined the context, made it easier to make judgments. Now, not everybody shared that idea, because most Americans are ahistorical, and some of our top politicians are ahistorical. They don't have any larger vision of the world. But that was my job to provide it, just as it was Kissinger's job to provide it. Today, I think we're in an age in which the struggle for global hegemony is finished. The struggle is now for global order, lest we degenerate into global chaos. I think that's what's new about our present condition. And you're a student, you're a scholar of the Middle East. Look at the Middle East. The choice is really either some new reality that's manageable or a pulverizing chaos. And this is the global condition. Now, I sometimes wonder whether our leaders understand that. My sense is occasionally some do. One of the things that initially impressed me so much about Obama was that I thought he understood that. I still think he does. But look at the Congress. Do you think many people in Congress really understand that? And then there's, you know, different implications of that. How do we avoid sliding into a conflict with the Chinese that unintentionally becomes a repetition of what happened in the 20th century?
So how, if you wanted to get the information into policymakers, would you do this? You talked about the huge crush of paper that comes at senior officials every day. Some people write little notes, little memos. How have you tried to push ideas directly into the process from outside of the process? And how would you suggest that people try to inject ideas into the system?
That has to differ from person to person. That is to say, it really depends on the personality of the president, if you're talking about that level, and of the ability of the National Security Advisor to meet his needs. I was very lucky because I knew the president well. I knew that he was very intelligent. I also knew that he was not a student of international politics and as such, so I could help him in that respect. But I tried to engage him in a kind of ongoing dialogue in two ways. One was I did the morning intelligence briefing, not the CIA. I did it. That is to say, I would get the president's daily brief. I would get also other things such as the INR reports from the Department of State. Maybe something would sometimes come in from defense. Sometimes some intercepts by the agency. I'd put it together, read it, make notes for myself. I'd make notes on the president's daily brief, and then I would go in first thing in the morning, first appointment of his, and give him a briefing on it, telling him what I think there are the highlights, what are the problematical issues, and also reminding him what that particular day is his agenda and the NSC's agenda for foreign policy, what kind of meetings, dignitaries, decisions to be made, and so forth. So that was a continuing dialogue, which sometimes on the weekends would then lead to more leisurely discussions about global trends and so forth. He's very bright, very engaged, wanting to be in charge of foreign policy and insisting that he be in charge of foreign policy. He was no front man for me, quite the contrary. But he at the same time knew that he could benefit from some inputs. So that was an important form of a daily dialogue. Secondly, in addition to that, at the end of the week, I would write him a long personal memo, just for him, for me, more or less sharing with him my thoughts about how we did that week. What did we do that was good? Where perhaps things are not moving rapidly enough? What are some of the bottlenecks? Where perhaps I dare to disagree with him, and why? So, you know, the one such letter, for example, I tried to draw some lessons from Machiavelli's Prince, how we have to act in the international scene, and he wrote on the margins, don't give me that kind of advice. Because he was very moral, and he really believed in being very direct and explicit. And, you know, Machiavelli's Prince has some alternative notions of how a prince should operate. But that was an important form of dialogue with him. And he would write marginal notes for me, or sometimes agree, or sometimes disagree, or whatever.
But you've been outside of that sort of daily contact for more than 30 years. How do you put ideas in now? How do you reach out to the current National Security Advisor or other senior people?
That depends entirely on their interest and receptivity. If some of them are occasionally interested, as some of them occasionally are, then you do it. If they're not, then you do it other ways, which is public. Public communication, which sometimes has some impact.
Do you send a lot of unsolicited notes into people, a couple paragraphs?
No. I don't do it unless I feel that there is some receptivity or interest, either because I know them well or because they occasionally call me in. But no, I don't spray around memos to people who are, you know, I don't think a single memo influences anyone unless it has some absolutely sensational or original idea, which they, when they read, immediately sense is of benefit to them. And you essentially operate either privately because you have contacts occasionally, or you operate publicly because you mobilize public support for that particular perspective. I, for example, have been participating in some debates lately on Libya earlier, and Syria more recently. You can do that. You know, people react to what you say, read it, some pick it up, some disagree with it. There are many ways of playing that game.
For younger people who want to have their ideas taken seriously, what kind of advice would you give them if they wanted to affect the public debate?
Well, have a connection with some sort of a patron, or somebody who is accessible and is willing to consider their views. And there is no secret, unique way of being relevant. And without exaggerating one's importance, I think it is fair to say relevance means that in some limited fashion, you are part of shaping reality. And that's about all. And one should not have a sweat head about it. You know, nobody. Outside of really uniquely important historical people, historical persons, really shapes history. But you can participate in it.
Where did you look for creativity when you were in government? Where do you think there's creativity both within government and outside of government now?
Well, first of all, I looked in here. You know, it has come from within. Creativity is fairly rare. Repetition of the obvious, elaborating it, and so forth. That's the predominant pattern. There has to be something in you that leads you to emphasize things which then attract others because there's something new, innovative about them, something that responds either to an opportunity or to a fear.
You've talked in very particular terms about staffing on the NSC. You kept it very small, relationships with individuals. But a lot of success in government has to do with navigating bureaucracies, working with bureaucracies, working with the interests of bureaucracies. As people think about working in the policy field, what, in your experience, do they need to know about bureaucracies, which are how so much of government gets done?
Well, so much of government gets done, but routine, that's what it gets done. Bureaucracies operate on the basis of routine. I think if, you know, if that is satisfying to someone, by all means, they should do it. But if you want to change something, to achieve something, you have to, in a way, be willing not to be part of the routine. Because the routine is essentially conservative. It's the status quo. Now, if things are going well, that's fine. You know, there was a time when our post office was quite efficient. That was routine. Then it decayed, and today routine essentially covers a mess, right? And that is true of most bureaucracies.
The New York Times Book Review recently spoke to Colin Powell and said, what book should everybody in government read? What book should the president read? And first he said, well, they should read The Best and the Brightest by David Halberstam. And then Colin Powell said, theories and grand ideas are important, but they seldom unfold as planned. People. It's all about people.
Well, it's, of course, it's all about people in the sense that people are involved. But it's not entirely all about people. I'm not sure I would give the same reading to a president. You know, the Halberstam book is a wonderful book. But it's about lessons that I think should have been learned by now. It essentially deals with our inability to confuse, to separate nationalism and communism. And in the case of Vietnam, the two were fused. And initially, most people didn't see it. I confess, I didn't see it initially. It was only after I went to Vietnam in 68 that I began to realize that nationalism is what gives vitality to the communism, and not the other way around. But, yeah, of course, people. That's what we operate with, people with people. I would say understanding what are the decisive forces of history in a given historical moment, which may last a century, may last half a century. History is accelerating, so perhaps it won't be as long as the previous century. But I personally think understanding that is the point of departure, at least for meaningful contributions in the realm of foreign policy. Now, there are other examples, how societies change. You know, why is it that our society, which has been so uniquely creative, competitive, and at the same time sensitive to some elements of egalitarianism, has now become so polarized in income and in views? There is a whole huge arena for creative thinking in this regard. What about the value system of a consumption-oriented society? Is the acquisition of material goods the endless end in itself of human pursuit? Is that a good point of departure for a healthy society? What about the question of equality, of opportunity in the face of death? That is to say, should everybody have a similar chance of survival? I mean, these are all terribly complicated political, moral issues that are in the forefront of the kind of dilemmas that policymakers will confront and which have to be, first of all, understood in their totality and from which you can then extract, hopefully, if you're lucky and creative enough, some sense of purpose and guidance. I think that's the most satisfactory life you can have.
But it seems that oftentimes, even writing about a decade, takes several decades of perspective to understand that. I mean, people are starting to come to some sort of consensus about how to write about the 60s and maybe about the 70s in your period when you were in government. How, if you're looking forward, do you capture the messiness, the complexity, that the sort of information richness of modern society? Because it seems to me that history won't do it for you. Political science is too theoretical. Sociology is too anecdotal. I mean, you can go through all the sciences, all the humanities, and it seems to me that it's harder and harder to talk about a single reality because there's just too much information to sort out.
You're absolutely right. I don't have a good answer for that. You're absolutely right. It's more and more complex and more difficult and diversified. But there are two words, perhaps, that can be part of an answer. One is in German, one is in English. Fingerspitzgefühlen. It's a wonderful German word. Fingerspitzgefühlen. The feeling at the tip of your fingers. And the English equivalent to that, in my mind, is intuition. Intuition is very important. Yeah. And this is why some people are creative and some people are not. I suppose in some simple statistical sense, you know, all human minds have comparable capacities, and we don't really know why some of them perform so much better than others. And some people have that Fingerspitzgefühlen historically and have an intuition. And then on top of it may have some driving experience which gives them relevance to that particular historical phase in terms of their quest for achieving something. These are not very good explanations because they're all ultimately vague, but that's the human condition. Everything we deal with is somewhat vague, uncertain. And this is why some people are leaders and some people are followers. Most people are followers.
Are you satisfied with the amount of intellectual personal leadership you've been able to exhibit in your career? Do you wish that you had an opportunity to have a greater impact or an impact in another area that because of your career path?
Not in another area, because the one that I chose, I think, is so comprehensive and enduring. There's enough there. Of course, I would have done, would have been happy to have done more. I wish I had. But I'm not, at the same time, a sort of a disappointed person. I feel rather gratified with the kind of life or career and family life that I have had.
Dr. Brzezinski, thank you very much for sharing your wisdom with us today.
I'm not sure I shared much, but
I learned a lot.
Thank you.
So thank you very much.
Thank you.